VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. What a weekend of Premier League football. Ladles of drama and late goals everywhere you looked, and we'll be discussing it all. Plus, as this enormous story involving the Spanish Football Federation president, Luis Rubiales, continues to make waves around the world, we'll be asking, is football failing women? No Tom Clark today, so you've got me, Gregor Robertson, alongside Tony Cascarino, Alison Rudd, and our North East football correspondent, Martin Hardy. Martin, ironically, given all the late drama yesterday, a very early start from you for you to on a tranquil bank holiday to come all the way from London. Great to have you here.
Come all the way to London from Newcastle. Indeed. Yeah, no. It was them trying to get to sleep last night ahead of an early train, and everything from the game just kept spinning. So much happened. The match was so breathless. Trent should have been sent off. Virgil van Dijk was sent off. Jurgen Klopp man-marked Jason Tindall out of the game every time he moved off the dugout. There was rows, finger shushing, and a sense of frustration on the Newcastle bench that they couldn't get the second goal, which in fairness they did deserve, 23 shots, I think it was 8 on target. But the more that went on, Liverpool came back in the game and just, awful phrase, game management, they just stayed in it. And then you've got this remarkable finish when Nunes comes on. Klopp admitted later that he was annoyed at being substitute. Jurgen Klopp says he used some of that anger to score the two late goals. And then by the finish, also must mention the atmosphere was ferocious. And at the end, Jurgen Klopp says that's the most dramatic game I've been involved in over 1,000 matches. And he thought, blimey, yeah. So yes, absolutely breathless. So
you even put it up there with the great comeback against Barcelona in the Champions League.
He said it was better than that.
Yeah.
He said that this was more difficult because he said that game was at home.
I mean, we're three games into the season. It's not a Champions League kind of knockout game. But, could this be a kind of a game that catapults Liverpool forward this season?
Absolutely. For outsiders, being told that match felt more significant than the 4-3 over Barcelona, that sounds peculiar, but actually, in Europe, Liverpool have a sense that all things are possible and all things are possible at Anfield. And I didn't feel any sense of stress for that match, knowing we were 3-0 down from the first leg. I felt it was entirely possible because of how well we'd actually played in defeat. There's something different about this set of circumstances, which is on the back of a disappointing season where Liverpool had not qualified for the Champions League. A slightly stuttering start to this campaign, not abysmal, but certainly not something that would take your breath away. You're going to St James's, which has one of the best atmospheres in the country, and they tore into Aston Villa and got lots of plaudits for that. Everything seems to go against Liverpool. They're sending off, and you feel, they weren't playing well to start with. They can't do it with 10 men. And yet, for them to find the resilience and the inspiration to pull it off against the odds away from Anfield, much more surprising than some of the European exploits Liverpool have had. So although I know it sounds like hyperbole, I completely get it. It was actually quite astonishing. And if they can't use that, the feeling of that, to really make this a season that they actually do have an assault on the title, I'd be very surprised.
Tony, let's get into some of the big talking points. First, Trent. Should he have been sent off? And then secondly, Van Dijk, should he have seen red?
Well, it's probably a yes and no on Trent, because first of all, the first tackle, which, you know, obviously was a foul, that made Trent get angry, and so he throws the ball. And yes, by the rules, you can get yellow carded for that. But I think ignoring the first challenge was a problem. The second incident, yeah, sending off, without a doubt, I don't disagree. I do have a bit of an issue with watching Joe Linton kick or make three pretty rash challenges during the game. And also Gramirez did it and never get punished. And then it's all on the what happened with Trent. I have a real issue with football where it's going, as we've touched many times, Gregor, on slight touches of somebody, you know, minimum contact. And I thought, Van Dijk, is that really a sending off for an instance? Yes, he clips him. I get that. Then he takes the ball. I thought it was a foul. Could you deem it yellow card? And I know the referees will come after and go, well, if he's the final man, it's a chance of scoring. I understand all of that. It just feels that there's such big advantages, even though Liverpool won the game. It's like the penalty. If you give soft penalties and coin flipping on penalties, there's such big advantages from 12 yards to score on a one-on-one and go into 11 men against 10. Normal circumstances, most teams will get over the line. Newcastle didn't yesterday. And I thought they did play well, Newcastle. They were a good side. We all know that. But I don't want the game, or even though some will say to me, well, the game is based on decisions. That, you know, it's always the outcome of a game is made on decisions. But if we make it the sole reason, which is decisions are becoming so regular and so often that ultimately, if you get the most decision, you're going to win way more games.
I'm baffled by the whole discussion on Trent, actually. I'm surprised at you, Tony, because it was a... You're right, there was an awful push by Gordon on...
It's a foul.
...on Trent. But his response to that, I didn't think it was either petulant or holding up play. He was lying on the floor and he just puts the ball back into play. I do not see why that's a cooking.
Jamie Carragher at half time saying we can't call it the obvious goal scoring opportunity because it hasn't happened. It's like, yes, but that's because of the foul. And it's like we are splitting hairs here. The ball was thrown back. Look,
it was not thrown back.
I always get annoyed that the person
that
doesn't
anger.
I always get annoyed that the retaliator is the person that gets punished. So I understand what he's saying. However, he did. We are trying to make a referee's life at whatever level of football a little bit easier. Just don't be petulant. Don't be wasting time. Don't show aggression towards the officials. He's had a little bit of a moment where he spat his dummy out and he's got booked for it. And maybe it's the fact that, what was it, a minute later? So it's the seventh minute when he makes the next foul on Gordon. Might be in the referee's head to think this is awfully early to send off an England right back.
Why do we think that is a yellow card?
Which one?
It was a foul, his slight push on Gordon.
Yes, after he's had his yellow?
Yeah.
When Gordon goes past him, I'm talking about... Both incidents happened within 7 minutes.
Yes.
That's the only thing I can think of why he stays on.
Neither were a booking. I don't know why people are saying he's lucky to be on the pitch.
Both of them were booked if they happen in isolation.
That was not a booking. He barely touched Gordon.
It was
a free kick.
Yeah.
But it wasn't a booking.
Is this really where we are on how we judge our sport? And you two are saying, yes, it was a booking. And we're saying, we don't think it should have been a booking. Or do you see what I mean? It's like...
Which one, so, the first one or the second one?
Well, I don't get how the push isn't deemed the first problem.
Yeah, but I agree with that.
I mean,
but both
it's so obvious. And, you know, I get it. He falls back and did he literally... You know, when sometimes players kick it away and it's gone sort of 20 yards away, I sort of think, OK, that's petulance, that's a yellow card. It wasn't quite like that. So I think it's a bit of a murky area. But if we're having two against two, is that how football's going to be? That basically decisions are just...
That's how football is always
you view
been.
It, now we view it. And there's... You know, you're talking about ultimate punishments for a team, for a side who's planning a game. So are we going to just guess on... You know, I play Guess Who with my boy. All right, and he says glasses. No glasses. Black hair. No. And it's a bit of a, well, yeah, guess what in football, is it?
Well, look, also, we're kind of, you know, there was some great drama and action involved in this game too, so maybe we should move on from
that. But I get what you're saying, because the game became less for the red card.
Yeah.
It then became a more tactical game in which Liverpool have to stay in it to have a chance with 20 minutes to go, whereas before that it had been the pace was just ferocious and the stadium was so loud. Everybody was bought in this game. This is two really good teams going for each other, and the game changes. But the referee can't say, I want this to be a good game of football, so I'll overlook the fact that Virgil van Dijk has just clipped the Newcastle forward, who was in an obvious goal scoring opportunity. The referee has to say, that's a red card. There's another issue about Virgil van Dijk to say, is this the follow-on from his injury? Is he not quite the same player that he was 2 or 3 years ago? That his timing at that level is, what, a fraction of a second off? Because he's very close to getting the ball completely, but he clips the centre forward first. I would say perhaps 3 years ago he cleans that up no problem.
Would you,
he doesn't get sent off.
Would you think,
but I think
that,
it's a red.
I mean, Al's done a refereeing. Is there, it's not a part of where a referee has to understand the feel of a game? Without going, yes, that's a, I have to do this on this instance.
But therefore you may see the referee did that for the potentially the second yellow card for Trent. The game was so quick, and yeah, it's still a tug that stops Gordon in full flight. And Gordon, by this
it's
stage
a touch,
in the game,
not a touch.
Well, whatever it is, it stops his path.
We're moving on from referees now. Because as you see, Newcastle were the better team when it was 11-11.
Eddie Howe bemoaned that afterwards. He said that sending off hurt us.
So you know, Newcastle are going to be. You saw Eddie Howe; he was crestfallen after this. It felt like a chance to kind of, I don't know, plant a flag in the turf and say we are a member of the.
I like Graham Souness. No, it did, and he was really crestfallen at the end of the game. Newcastle kind of do that lap of honour, win, lose or draw. Generally, it's been a win, and the stadium suddenly, from being very full of noise, he was more or less empty, apart from the celebrating Liverpool fans. And he was stood there in the centre circle for about a minute on his own, looking into space to think, what on earth just happened here? And he's aware as anybody else. He's a bright bloke. That's 11 defeats now to Klopp, and 5 defeats to Liverpool on the trot since he's been the Newcastle manager. This is a big game. He needs to win big games. Newcastle got beat off Manchester City and didn't play very well the week before. They played really well yesterday, and on another day may have won that match. Brilliant save from Alisson from Miguel Almirón. That goes in. It's 2-0. It's 10 men at half-time. Newcastle fancy their chances. These are big games that he needs to start winning, so he's aware of what the implications are, and that's a massive missed opportunity yesterday. I said, you know, this is low as you felt as Newcastle manager. Newcastle lost in the 98th minute at Anfield last season when the benches were fighting each other, and he said, yeah, it's right up there with them. So it's a big moment for him. It's a big opportunity for him to create some momentum. Newcastle now go to Brighton on Saturday, trying not to lose 3 games on the trot.
I'm interested because you were there. So I was watching on TV, and it might be different, but it seemed to me that Howe was and the players were trying to take the emotion out of the game when they had the man advantage. As though they felt, we don't want to get sucked into a passion play here. We have got the man advantage. We can play sensible football, and it didn't feel like it felt like the crowd had bought into that as well, and that the hysteria level dropped, and there was a sense of let's just be sensible and we'll win 1 or 2-0. It was as though their trump card wasn't there.
Goal. He wanted the second goal, and he admitted that. He has faced criticism for the substitutions. When a player is playing as well as Anthony Gordon was, the temptation would be to leave him on. And he said afterwards, look, he watches the matches on the night time when he goes home. And he said, there's loads of things you would do differently. And he was pushed on that one. Would you leave Gordon on? And he hasn't had much criticism from Newcastle fans, but there has been criticism last night. And this morning, a player's doing that well. And even at the start of the second half, 3 times he goes past Trent again, he should probably left him on. He said, I wanted that second goal. And Almirón hits the post. Almirón has the shot saved. There's 23 shots. I think Liverpool played it that well. Klopp substitutions were that well that he took a bit of the heat out of the game because that's the only way that he could stay in it. It was like a basketball game at the start. If that stays at 11-10, Liverpool can't keep up. And he said Joel Matip came off because he was exhausted. His players were tired. So for him, it was kind of just stay in this, whereas Howe was slightly critical of his players. He said, we were looking for too much control at 1-0. He said, I wanted the second goal. It's whether or not his substitutions were negatively impacting upon his team, whereas Klopp's were obviously very positive.
Klopp's changed the game. And we have to talk about Darwin Nunes. Yeah. I mean, this could be a kind of a game changer for his career as well, Liverpool, Tony.
Yeah, and look, Eddie Howe will look at him and think, wow. I've watched this lad. He would have seen him enough, nearly as much as Klopp, his manager, and gone, he's not clinical enough. And any Liverpool fan would say, you know, that is the case. He's just not taken, because he had a lot of chances last year.
He had a chance before he scored as well, and he miscontrolled it.
I mean, on any given day, that is up there with the best two finishes I've ever seen. First one, because he's been struggling, he's been put on the bench, he gets called upon with 10 men and gets a little bit fortunate because it bounces off of Botman. But as soon as it comes to him, he knows he needs to take a touch before he shoots. You know, so he knows that's the way he has to score. And he's only putting it in one place to beat Pope there. Pope's getting it in 90% of the, or 99% of the positions with his goal. He knows that Pope's positioned perfectly for that effort. And, you know, he knows where he's trying to do. And the second finish was a consequence of how finished he finished. He finished the first one because that is a striker in confidence. You know, I've always said, I've been lucky. I've played with some great strikers in my career. And most of us, you know, we always go down the goalkeeper union, don't we? Our goalkeepers are completely bonkers and blah, blah, blah. Forwards are. There's a lot of forwards I played with who are bonkers, right? Who solely think about goals, sometimes don't even care about how the team get on, but will just think goals. Now, for the team, that's great because goal scorers ultimately can change games. Yesterday was a game that was won by Liverpool, and fair play to them for the way the manager has done it, but it's basically been won by two amazing finishes.
What you mentioned there was interesting when you talk about the confidence a player gets. We do forget players are human beings sometimes. Yeah. So Newcastle play Aston Villa, Harvey Barnes and Callum Wilson come on. Harvey Barnes charges down the left not long after coming on, crosses, Callum Wilson scores, life's great. A couple of minutes later, Harvey Barnes goes down the left, crosses and Callum Wilson misses. So a couple of minutes later, Harvey Barnes goes down the left again, and this time it's like, well, you missed the last one, so I can do this on my own. Shoots and scores, everything's great.
Yeah.
He goes through yesterday after coming on as sub, and he's muddled, and he's like, Wilson's there in the ready to potentially score the second goal, and Barnes takes a little bit too long with the cross, and then he thinks, I don't know if I can shoot, and then he comes back on his right and has this shot that's blocked, and you're thinking, oh, that's because of what's happened in the last game.
Yeah.
And you've made the bad decision. You make the right decision there, Callum Wilson scores, we're sitting here going, Newcastle might be a team to win the title, and it spins on those little moments.
Yeah.
Martin, finally, you wrote about this before the game, that there's a bit of a rivalry developing between these two teams now, and it kind of, it's mouthwatering for the future as well. You know, they're obviously competing for the Champions League and possibly more. And there was more tension, and we saw Jason Tindall giving Klopp the shush.
Well, it's interesting. I think Manchester City are way miles above everybody else. I think they're just too good. Watched them against Newcastle last week, and Newcastle couldn't lay a glove on them. And tactically, I think Pep is streets ahead of all of them. So that means you've got the rest. They're all fighting against each other. It's Arsenal, Liverpool, Newcastle, Man United, maybe, although they're having one of their wobbles at the minute. So and for Newcastle to progress and for Eddie Howe to progress, he has to move beyond Liverpool. Within that, you get these really nasty rivalries, and the Tindall one and Klopp one's really interesting to watch. And you're quite fortunate the Newcastle press box is in a great position. You really need a dugout. And you could see that Klopp's watching the game and he's watching the ref, but he's also watching Jason Tindall for the entire game to make sure that he doesn't stand next to Eddie Howe, because that breaks the rules on two officials being in the technical area together. And you're thinking, this incredible bloke who's won the European Cup and Champions League is still at this level of, I'm watching you. And as soon as the appeal was made against Trent for his second yellow and Tindall came in to stand beside Howe, Klopp's shouting at the ref to make sure he doesn't send off, but then he's shouting at Tindall to sit down, screaming at him, and Tindall's putting his finger to his mouth. And these are supposed to be grown blokes at the top of the profession. That's what the pressure's done to him. So when we're arguing about referees making decisions, the game makes us all go slightly mad at times. And you're watching this thing, good grief, Klopp, you've done so much. But Tindall's wound him up, and at the end of the game, there was a picture, but I don't know when it was from, of Klopp doing the shush back with his fingers to his mouth. So you should always wait before, I think, you claim the victory on these ones.
Isn't it funny, a rivalry that one team's not beating them for God knows when. So what's the rivalry?
They are fighting for the same space.
I think there was a stat where, you know, they finished 4 points clear of them last season. The season before, there was like a 40-point gap or something. So
you turn about in terms of how Newcastle have caught
the development. Very, very quickly.
But that's what they need to achieve, a rivalry. That means beating Liverpool. And that's something that's not happened. And it was very close yesterday. Give Newcastle the credit for that.
Yeah, it was a modern classic, I think. And there was another humdinger at Old Trafford. Manchester United 3, Nottingham Forest 2. More late goals, another comeback. Forrest went 2-0 up inside the opening 4 minutes. Eriksen pulled one back. Casemiro equalised. Joe Worrall was sent off for Nottingham Forest. And then Marcus Rashford won a penalty, which Forrest were not very happy about. And Bruno scored the winner from the spot. another bonkers game, Tony.
Yeah. I was at Brentford and watching the game, and like probably many people over the country, after 5 minutes, and looked round and said, it's 2-0 to Forest already. Like, and everyone, really? And because there's so many Man United supporters around in the country, and you normally generally get a United fan with you or around you. And he went, and he's going, no, already, we're useless. You know, like, I'm laughing, like thinking, you know, how this sport that I've loved for many years, the way that people react to it. Was I surprised? Well, of course, yes, of 2-0. Was I surprised when I look back at the goals that they conceded? No, I'm not. That's their issue that they've shown already in this season, that teams can break on them really quickly and they get caught literally treading water, United. So they're going to have to overcome that. But, the first goal was typical of, you know, breaking. Marcus Rashford ended up alongside Awoniyi. Oh, I'll say alongside. He's probably got 6 or 7 yards to catch up because he's quick enough to catch most players. But it was a strange one. I've been part of games like that where you've got away with one. United have got away with two at home. You know, so they've played two home games. Wolves, they got away with it. And they've got away with it against Forest at the weekend. So Ten Hag knows that. You play an elite team, one of the top six in or top four teams, they're going to punish you. And I think he's very fully aware of that is a bigger problem that he has to overcome at United.
Isn't it interesting, though, that, okay, they've won their two opening home games, but neither club, neither Wolves nor Forest, were the least bit intimidated by being at Old Trafford at all. They both of them played expansive, fast-paced football with a sense of freedom and enjoyment, and so anyone neutral would have thought, oh, I want them to, you know, I want Wolves and Forest to win because they're playing the football I want to see, and they're playing it at Old Trafford. There is nothing about United that scares anybody anymore.
And Wolves have had a manager for a week and were a club in chaos and had no money, and they go to Old Trafford and put money there on the back foot. It was amazing.
Well, it's a tin hat job. You know, in my day, you went to Old Trafford, you didn't only have to suffer how good they were technically, but they were really good at battling. They could stand up, match you, and they didn't give you an inch. And I look, clubs do so much work on looking at their opposition. You know, they dissect everything they do. And that's an example of two clubs, like Alison's just mentioned, who have gone, do you know what, we can hurt them. And we will. And that's been proven the case. You can hurt United.
There's a slight tactical element. Newcastle played yesterday and they left Sean Longstaff as the deepest defender for a corner, and he's an attacking midfielder. And Liverpool broke. The first goal for Nottingham Forest, the deepest defender was Marcus Rashford. So Rashford chases him down and gets within 2 yards of him and then goes, I've got no idea what to do next. And his age is from the score of the goal. And he's like, I don't know what to do. I got in the penalty area, I caught him up, and then I was like, I don't know what to do. But on Rashford, Rashford assists or kind of plays an important part in two of the goals, then gets a penalty. And for Rashford, and the Man United keeps spending money, Rashford is getting into that list of Kane and Shearer where they are helping the club out so many times when the club is making bad decisions with recruitment. You're coming back to the same player to try to get them out of a difficult situation. I still would like to see Marcus Rashford have kind of conquered that position as working as a central striker, but for whatever reason he doesn't. He seems to work better from the left. He has everything to be that modern day centre forward who is quick, strong, can work, but that doesn't seem to happen for him. But he's just such a vital player for that team who are struggling, have probably had a bad summer. And if, as you said there, Tony and Alison, if Wolves and Nottingham Forest are going to Old Trafford thinking we can win, then Liverpool, Newcastle and everybody else are thinking, yeah, we fancy this.
But that's it. Really interesting what you said about why Rashford can't sort of decide in his head, I can be a central striker. What, I mean, you're a striker, Tony. Why would someone who's so good at goal scoring not want to be the central striker?
I've looked at his numbers over the last 7 years, Rashford, and I've always felt you have to really go to an isolated season, apart from his debut time when he first got in the team at Old Trafford, where he looked stunning and he played off that left. His numbers were only really good last year. Now, I'm not sure that you can convince everybody that you can do this again. I was so looking forward to seeing Rashford this year, and I know he hasn't scored and he's got a long way to go. Can he sort of replicate or even get more goals than last season? at Old Trafford. I've never been convinced because I don't think he's been clinical enough. You have to have a certain standard at Manchester United of being a finisher. And you only have to look at the centre forwards they've had, you know, from Dwight York to Van Nistelrooy to Berbatov or many others. You could list is endless. But you have to have a certain standard. I think he's a hell of a player, and I totally agree with Martin. He can change games. But it's not really... He doesn't seem to change games being the centre-forward. I remember watching him get two goals at PSG one night in the Champions League. And I thought... And he hadn't been playing well at that time. And you come away and you think, if you was watching him for the first time, you'd be raving about Rashford. You would. You'd be raving about him. He's got everything. Pace, power. He was shooting. He hit one from distance. And I think he still has to, if you're going to be a Man United regular centre-forward, you have to be a numbers man week in, week out. I mean, look, in the paper today it says, you know, United need Hoyland. You know, they do. And it'll be interesting to see. I think it's hard with Anthony. If I'm a centre-forward and I've got Anthony on one side of me, I think that makes job for Marcus Rashford even harder. Because I haven't got a clue what he's doing.
Yeah. As you see, Paul Hurst's written about that today in the game. And he's also referenced Anthony Martial, which making his 300th appearance kind of was gobsmacking to me.
Lindelof's in his seventh or eighth season. You're like, this might be.
And every season it feels like, you know, he needs to move on, and it just doesn't happen. Yeah. He's made 300 appearances for Manchester United.
And
he touched the ball 20 times, and he was dragged after an hour. So
they had the Premier League years on the other day, and I caught it was 08, 09, and Man United had Ronaldo, Rooney,
Tevez.
Berbatov, and Tevez.
Yeah.
And them four are just so far ahead of what they have at the minute.
Yeah,
there's a lot of pressure on Hoyland, isn't there?
Absolutely, yeah. Should also reference that thousands of Manchester United fans stayed in their seats for an hour after the final whistle to protest against the Glazer family, imploring them to sell the club. We've kind of already touched on it, but it does feel like no matter what Erik ten Hag does, until there's some sort of resolution to that, that Manchester United are just stuck in this cycle of, you know, feeling like they're progressing and then the tumult kind of getting hold of them again, and it feels like they can't escape that.
But is that an excuse? He's had a lot of backing, Ten Hag. He's been allowed to impose his personality. The obvious example being getting rid of Ronaldo. He's being given that sense of you are the heir to Ferguson, you have what you need, you do what you want to do. I think it's a slight
early,
excuse
he might be,
to
he
say
might not be the
it's
right
an
man,
ownership
but it's still
thing.
Very early. He might not be the right man long term, but what we're talking, 12 months, he's just been able to sign Johnny Evans. And I'm not saying he is the right man. I'm just saying recruitment-wise and everything else about that club is so far behind Man City. Man City will probably spend 180 million quid this summer on an international centre-half, two international midfielders, and Man United getting Johnny Evans and a kid up front. So I'm not sure if Ten Hag is the right man, because they're awful away from home and getting to top 10. But it just, as long as there's that chaotic feel of a football club, it's very rare that they're successful.
I know another keeper's come in, which would have been the manager's choice. And Martinez came in, you know, again, that would have been Ten Hag having a big involvement in that.
And Anthony. That's
not necessarily a good thing.
No.
His fingerprints are all over everything that's been positive about the club. It just still feels like everything's still around them, whether it's on-field or off-field issues. It feels like they're still stuck in this cycle, and he's finding it very hard to shake free. That's part of why the kind of mystique about Old Trafford has been eroded as well, I think.
Yeah. Imagine if Forest win, okay? I know it's a hypothetical question, but imagine what would be the papers be all about this morning? In the manner they played, and if they'd have lost that game, it would have been serious stuff, I would have said, this week, all about... There would have been loads of articles about Ten Hag and what's happened, who he's bought, and how it hasn't quite worked out. You know, they were that close to that sort of reporting on Monday morning.
And we should give Forrest some credit. They were excellent. And Taiwo Awoniyi's scored in his seventh game in a row. He's been transformed. I remember in the start of last season, I think he scored two in his first 10. And we were thinking, this is not the guy to score the goals for Nottingham Forest, to be polite about it. He's been transformed.
Now he's got Jamie Vardy's record in his sights.
Indeed.
If he's going to just keep on going. I mean, that's a bit outliery, isn't it? That Forest are a team that you think their priority is not to get relegated. And yet they are capable consistently of producing thrilling football.
But not a win on the road.
But they can't see it out. They can't see it out. No. It is interesting. They probably, I don't know, score too soon, perhaps.
There were reports after this as well that Nottingham Forest were going to make an official complaint about some of the refereeing decisions in this game, which, you know, you'd raise your eyebrow about.
Well, okay, but the coin flip, the Rashford on the penalty. Pen or no pen?
Just about.
I'm only because I don't like penalties being given for very minor things. I would have gone probably not.
Probably not.
So I was going to say something else about that point. Now, Newcastle went to the Premier League last year after three or four decisions they felt were against them, and they were given loads of assurances that everything would be fine once Howard Webb came in.
Well, no, I don't want to labour on this, but there's already been 9 red cards this season. There were 31 the whole of last season. Do we think that the new directives, particularly with regard to dissent and time wasting, are heaping even more pressure on referees now who are already dealing with VAR?
I got sent off 9 times in my career. In the modern game, I get sent off 30. Right? So don't be surprised if everybody's numbers. I wouldn't have classified myself as a fug on the football pitch.
Gary
Lineker could get 2
weekend.
Sending offs and 50 yellow cards in the modern game. He had 1 in his career, didn't he? 1 yellow. The game is going, it's being watered down and it feels like sanitised in every way that you don't have to do much. I've had this discussion, I said off air to Martin and Al, but why is football so popular? Because it's controversial. It's a game that a lot of people feel like it reflects what life's about in some ways. And I've always felt, well, there's a reason why it's number one sport in the world. It's because it is. It's a reflection of life in general, in a way. American football, baseball, and ice hockey—they are punch-ups on the game. Now, we're not there. We make out like this is an ice hockey game. It's not.
Klopp and Tindall should have a fight at half time.
I get very passionate about this because it really bothers me how we keep sanitised. So we go forward 10 years time. What direction is it going to go? It's certainly not going to allow it to be a bit tougher and harder, is it? It's going to go even worse.
Well, it's backfired. The new directives for booking players for time wasting or acts that are seen to be time wasting. The philosophy behind that is that the paying fans should see more football and less nonsense. Mm. But actually, paying fans want to see 11 against 11, and they don't want to see a player who, does something that isn't hurting anybody and is, you kick the ball away 10 yards and you might get a booking for it because you haven't got used to the new directive. It's what you've done throughout your whole childhood and career. And then they make a foul a bit later on and that's a second yellow and they're off. This is why there's so many red cards, because your first yellow is nothing and then you forget that you're not allowed to even tackle anymore just in case it's deemed a yellow card. And but the whole point of bringing in the extra yellows was for the fans, and the fans are the ones who are being shortchanged because you don't want to see, although it brought about a fantastic match at St James's Park, that's not what football is. You shouldn't be playing against the odds of having a man down for most of the match. The whole philosophy behind it is flawed. This is supposed to be good for the fans, and I don't think you'll find a single fan who's enjoying the new directive.
I want the ball in play more. And it's up 4 minutes per game. I can't stand the time waste, and I can't stand the keeper's taking ages with a goal kick.
They're never booked.
I can't stand the keeper catching the ball and then lying on his stomach for 2 minutes.
He's never booked that either.
Yeah, but I'm saying, but so therefore, if you would like that, what you're trying to do is you're trying to get the game moving. I still get annoyed watching corners when people are grappling with each other and throwing each other to the ground, thinking, how is that not a free kick? Sorry, how is that not a penalty? Or how is not a free kick to the defending side? Or how is it not a penalty? People have got their arms around each other. So I'm maybe in the minority in this room. I want the game to flow. I want it fast. I think the game gets better all the time in terms of its pace. It's the flair players that I want to watch.
Yeah. Well, the way we're going, Martin, soon we'll be getting players being done for speeding because they run too quick. Someone say you're over 20 miles an hour, you're getting
the yellow card. We want them faster. We don't want them getting their shirts grabbed.
Very quickly, one more thing.
So one last thing. Trent could have been sent off in the goal because he grabbed Gordon's shirt and at the last second he let him go.
Yes,
and he would have been off for that. So,
very quickly, what did we make of Mike Dean's recent interview where he basically admitted, he basically confirmed everything we've spoken about for a long time on this podcast, Alison.
Yeah, yeah.
That the relationship between referees and the VARs is too close.
You shouldn't have referees operating the VAR, and he's proven it's right, because you're not being you're supposed to be objective behind a screen, and you're supposed to be helping out an on-field official because he doesn't have access to all the angles. He's seen it once. So in theory, you're there offering the objective view. And Mike Dean has more or less admitted they're more worried about how it looks for the on-field referee and how he'll be perceived if you keep pointing out errors he's made, which is why you should not have your mates in the VAR room.
Do we believe Mike Dean? Because in 2022, he said, I didn't see it as violent conduct. In the same interview with Simon Jordan, he said, I didn't see it as a foul. And then he gives the story about his mate. And I'm thinking...
He has since rolled back a bit on it.
I'm thinking, are you trying to make a
better story? I should probably just say, for anyone who doesn't know what this is, it was in reference to when Christian Romero pulled Cucurella's hair and pulled him to the floor in a game between Spurs and Chelsea last season. And he didn't send Anthony Taylor to the screen because he said he was a mate. So he's since said that it was blown, that you're a mate, the six of you working on the kind of, you know, on the pitch and at Stockley Park are like a team and you're mates for the day. So he's tried to roll back from it a little bit. But I think undoubtedly he did kind of lift the curtain and show us that there is too close a relationship between the referees on the pitch.
There should be no relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah. I was going to say, Ivan Tony got a huge ban for gambling, okay, on games. And, you know, you could make a small argument, although I don't agree with it, that, you know, is there an element of someone saying to you, well, that's sort of Max fiction in some sort of way. Now, that's an extreme view. Yeah? That's an extreme view. But you influence the outcome of a game. If you're prepared to do that, and, you know, you're not protecting your mate, that's nonsense. Because... 2 years later, or when was the game? Was it a year
last
ago?
Season.
Okay, so a year later, you end up then telling everyone that you knew it was a foul.
When you retired.
Yeah, when you retired, and you're helping your mate out. That's throwing your mate under the bus, in my opinion. Yeah,
so you didn't want to stitch his mate up, and he has spectacular. Yeah. A year and a half later. So, well done. Thanks, mate.
Okay, if you're enjoying the podcast, make sure you're subscribed, and you can get all our great content on the Times website. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for the latest subscription offer.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at Burrow.com/ACAST, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/ACAST.
So I think you would probably have to have been hiding under a rock to have missed the story developing in Spain involving Luis Rubiales. The Spanish Football Federation president kissed the Spain forward Jenny Hermoso on the lips on the podium during Spain's Women's World Cup win over a week ago. Hermoso has since said the kiss wasn't consensual. He's now been suspended by FIFA. I think the Spanish government are now trying to find a way to get him dismissed. This is a continuously developing story. But Alison, the story and Rubiales' reaction, including that extraordinary press conference on Friday when he repeatedly kind of shouted that he would not resign, it's unleashed a bit of a tsunami of feeling in Spain and Europe and across the world about how women are treated in football and in wider society. It's been pretty remarkable, hasn't it?
It's like an episode of The Handmaid's Tale, to be honest. A dystopia where women are viewed as an underclass and should do what men say. And if a man wants to kiss you smack on the lips in public, he should be allowed to do it. I'm not actually a big fan of people losing their jobs for errors of judgment. And I think he could have kept his job if he'd said, I was completely out of order. I was just so pleased we'd won. I forgot myself and I unreservedly apologise. And I think he'd have been fine. But instead, for some absolutely bizarre reason, he's got a wealth of support behind him within the Spanish FA. And he decided he would... Did you see this? They broke down the act of the kiss to prove that the player, Hermoso, had actually instigated it. That's what makes it like a dystopia. That is unbelievable and must be incredibly upsetting for her to not only have suffered the embarrassment. And initially she didn't go over the top about it. She just said, I'd rather it hadn't happened. You know, she didn't go crazy. But now to be... her bosses, if you like, to be telling the world she demanded the kiss, instigated the kiss and forced the kiss is beyond embarrassing. It's really quite hurtful. And you have to worry about what this... It's just very strange that it's happening within the team that won the World Cup. So first of all, I have huge admiration for the women that managed to put everything that had gone on behind the scenes for them to win it. They require extra plaudits for that. But this isn't a one-off act, is it? It's symptomatic of an FA in a country where they don't seem to respect women or treat them as equal sports people at all. The manager was seen as controlling and slightly peculiar, but he had the backing of the Spanish FA. Players resigned from the team. Some came back, some were dropped. To get to win it with that backdrop, but it proves that they've been fighting against the system throughout, and then it's been crystallised by this single moment and one man's inability to see that it's entirely inappropriate behaviour, and to then flip it and try and, I don't know, some people have called it gaslighting. I mean, it's just appalling behaviour. And that press conference where he'd been teared up as he's going to resign, and at the moment you think, oh, well, eventually the right thing's going to happen. It's like a Hitler blooming rally. I will not resign. I will not resign. And then everyone's cheering in the audience because they're all male. Men. They're all male and they're all male and they're all mates. They've all helped each other out when there've been complaints. They've all backed each other. It's appalling and backward. And I feel it's slightly surreal that we are talking about it now. This sounds like something that would have happened in the 70s. I can't quite believe it. It is happening. And they won the World Cup. Bless them. And no one's talking about that. They're talking about how dysfunctional Spanish society is and the Spanish FA are. So, like I say, I don't think the act of the kiss in itself is the most appalling thing to have happened. But the way it's been handled is atrocious.
As Ali said, you get the detail of this. So she's just won the World Cup and they're on the aeroplane heading home. And aeroplanes are quite tight for space. And it's at that point that she revealed she was put under pressure and she was sat with her family. So she's celebrating winning the World Cup, at which point she gets pressure from the Spanish FA to release a statement. See, at that moment, I guess what they're leaning over her, that these blokes are saying, do this, do this. In her statement, she says, I felt vulnerable. I was not respected. I was asked to make a joint statement to alleviate the pressure on the president. There was continuous pressure. So once this starts, that's the joy of the World Cup, I think, gone. because you're sitting with your family and you should be like, this is the greatest period ever. So there's so many elements of it that are appalling, and why it's just such a huge story, and you would like it to be a watershed moment that these miserable middle-aged blokes who govern football get moved on. But then you see Donald Trump on the front of most newspapers celebrating a mugshot, and you think, no, we're not going to get to that point, but this may bring about some element of change in the governance of football. For what she's had to go through, and as you've said, Ali, it must have completely spoilt this World Cup victory. Nobody's talking about how technically brilliant the Spanish were, how much ahead they were of the English players, instead of which in this seediness of the Spanish FA and people that, as you said, it just got worse and worse and worse. And you're like, what have they done now? What have they done now? And it was four pitches, I think, they'd got to try and prove that it was her fault. And then
she lifted him off the floor. Yeah. Right, so they were just
yeah. Same, and then at 8:24
gagging
on Friday,
for it is what they're trying to portray.
And 8:24 on Friday night, she then says, "I'm on strike from Spain," and all the Spain players say, "Yeah, we're on strike too." Anything? They won the World Cup a week ago. Imagine if that was a man's team. Within 6 days of winning the World Cup, they all go on strike. So yes, incredible.
Yeah, it's, you know, I tried to think it from a different way, as in taking layers off of the actual incident and thinking, started thinking myself. Who do I kiss on the lips in my life? So it's obviously my wife. As I've got older, my mum has become more affectionate. She will give me an odd peck on the lips. That's it. That's it. In any other shape or form, I'm not. I started to think about Al. I started to think about Alison before knowing she was coming today. We've done interviews together. Yeah, we've done interviews. Gone to Sheffield United. We've gone to interview Telly Sheringham. We've gone to Exeter. Stay over in Exeter. And I was kept thinking, if Alison won the ultimate prize in you know, as a writer.
Which I have.
Yeah, which you have, yeah. And I see you and I'm delighted for you. Would I kiss you on the lips? No, I wouldn't. Because I know that's a line that, it's an uncomfortable line for a president. I mean, look, we had the FAI in Ireland and they did quite a bit wrong for a number of years. And they were, you know, and it wasn't the men or women to do that. They were just, a lot of controversy was surrounding them. And I always think back of, they sort of had their own seating on the plane. They're not really with the players. Most of them, we spent all our international football. We would be in second class going to play the game and the first class would be full of all the representatives of the FAI. So it was always sort of them and us. And I would imagine it probably would be the same with the Spanish as well. But I don't know how he gets to thinking, even with the, you know, the delight and the enthusiasm and incredible moment of winning World Cup, you still put a smacker on a player. I don't get that.
Well, what's interesting, you kind of look for examples in your life of who you kiss on the lips. And I, when you see him celebrating the goal by grabbing his groin, I then thought... I then went, rattled my brain. I thought, thankfully, I don't know anybody. None of my friends grabbed their groin. That's a relief. So the only two people I could think of that I was aware of, one was Lord Flashheart in Blackadder. And the other one was Michael Jackson in the Thriller video. Yeah. And I'm like, they're from the 1980s. Come on. And they were largely taking the you know what. So for him to still be doing that in the crowd at a major event, you think, you're 40 years out of time.
Yeah. Jonathan Northcroft's written a really fascinating piece this weekend in Sunday Times, which was headlined "Football's Nasty Truth: It's Badly Failing Women," and in it he discusses some of the missteps we've seen recently with Rubiales, with Manchester United's handling of Mason Greenwood, and also a kind of fairly lengthy list of footballers who have, you know, either mistreated or abused women, allegedly or otherwise, going back a number of years. So the fundamental question that he's trying to answer in this piece is whether football as an industry and footballers' attitudes towards women is an issue, or whether it kind of is mirroring wider society. Alison, what do you think?
I don't think football does mirror wider society. Exactly. I think it's a special case because you get a lot of young men who are suddenly famous and have money and not necessarily very well educated. They've put all their eggs in the football basket. They've neglected their education, and they have their way of celebrating that status is to have parties and invite people to the parties, and they treat women as commodities. So even the various cases of where players have been accused of rape and been cleared, they've not been cleared of their lifestyle choices. And a lot of the women involved are young, they're teenage girls. And you think, well, the girls go along because they're very excited probably to be in the company of someone so famous or rich, and it's seductive in itself. And then they find themselves caught up in a party atmosphere that might not be exactly what they thought they were getting into, but they go along with it, and afterwards they feel pretty disgusted with themselves and maybe bring a complaint, and then maybe they're told, well, don't worry, you'll get a payoff, it'll be fine. The whole culture of that, that isn't society, because most young men aren't in that privileged position. And it does mean that clubs are neglecting their, well, they're neglecting their position, really. They have academy. Everyone has academies now, and they're supposed to hold classes and teach their young players about, you know, be careful what you say on social media, and be careful about entrapment, and be careful about sleeping with girls who are underage, who are wearing a lot of makeup and might be overage. How about telling them to treat women with respect, especially young girls? You know, it's appalling that this is par for the course, that you have these parties that lots of players go to, and you know, shagging around all night, multiple partners, seems to be acceptable. And I know that's not illegal, but it is breeding a culture of complete lack of respect, which can verge towards sexual assault or rape, and blur the lines of that, because there'll be so much alcohol and so on, and just abuse of power or differential in age and so on. I'm loath to say it exactly reflects society, because I think that is a specific cauldron of toxic stuff going on that you don't get necessarily exactly reflected.
You know, what we're talking about here as well, and I noticed this in my football career, that there was an element of people, and Alison used the word privileged position. That privilege comes with an element of feeling bulletproof. And bulletproof is where they think they are, and they're not. So they take advantage with that feeling of thinking, well, I can do it, get away with this. You know, even to the music that players listen to, you know, some of the stuff they listen to is like, I've even talked to my boys. I've got five boys. Alison's got two boys, haven't you, Al? And I talked to my boys about some of the stuff that's being said, and, you know, in their music, the songs. And it's, you know, you've got to get in your head that it's a very dangerous place to go. And I remember thinking that as a player, because there was loads of party years ago. You know, you go to the Republic of Ireland, where, you know, this thing, you had to be very careful. And by your behaviour, I'm not speaking about who you meet, it's actually about your behaviour as well. You're always one bad step away from a lot of trouble, but there is that bulletproof feeling sometimes with players, and I think that's what they can't seem to understand. You're not bulletproof.
Okay. Should we get back to the football?
I feel quite depressed now.
Yeah. I think they might feel that way at the Emirates as well after Fulham's late equaliser. Another game with late drama. Arsenal gifted Fulham the lead with probably a contender for the strangest goal of the season, would we say? Bukayo Saka passing the ball straight to Pereira, Andreas Pereira. And then I think he tried to lob Aaron Ramsdale, who tried to predict that he was going to lob him. and he just somehow whipped it into the near post. Bizarre goal, Martin.
Yeah. I watched Aaron Ramsdale for a season when I'm not at Sheffield United, and when they got relegated, and I didn't think he was very good. So I would go home to my son, who's now 17, and say Aaron Ramsdale's rubbish. Although I'm usually quite gentle with opinions. And then last season, whenever Aaron Ramsdale had a good game, it was like, Aaron Ramsdale's had another good game, Dad. I was like, yeah, I've spotted it. But I always had that nagging doubt. But it means that if I do see a mistake from him, I jump on it. I thought that was a mistake for the first goal. I wonder if Arsenal are serious about winning the title, whether having England's third best goalkeeper and probably what the sixth best goalkeeper in the league is going to be good enough to get you there. They're letting 10 more goals than Man City and Newcastle last season. Rea's there now, and I think he'd be putting pressure on him. I have a theory in my head, which I haven't tested out, that the team that wins the title has generally got one of the two best goalkeepers in the division. I think you could probably go back historically and find that. I don't think he's top-notch to win, if you're talking about winning the Premier League title. And I thought that was a bad mistake. And same with Nottingham Forest. If the unfancy team gets a foothold in the game, it changes the game completely. And from then, Fulham have got their tails up, and that gives them maybe the belief to come back at the end to grab a point in that 2-2. So it's an error from Arsenal not to beat a Fulham side that's without Mitrovic, and seem feels like it's got lost a little bit of its momentum from last season. You know, they've changed personnel. Still not sure whether I would like to see Declan Rice play as a sitting midfielder for Arsenal. But Pep seems to have completely changed where that play has to be now, because with Partey coming in from the right-back position to sit, and therefore Declan Rice goes further on, it's probably complicated what he does. It's just, can they kick on from last season? At the minute, I'm not quite sure.
Mikel Arteta's clearly trying to evolve this team in the way that they play, but it's not quite clicking yet, is it, Tony?
No, and I was really surprised that Trossard was played in the centre-forward position, and Nketiah would have stuck in all day long. I know, again, in hindsight, that's easy, but I thought that was a strange one. He's looked very sharp, even in the game at Crystal Palace, where he wins a penalty and just basically looked like he was... Anderson's a good centre-half. Gueye as well, at Crystal Palace. They're two good centre-halves. He was giving them a tough time, Eddie, in the way he was playing, just by his movement. And I thought a little bit tricky there. I just want to make one point, because Martin Maeder talked about Ramsdale. Chrissy Wilder had Ramsdale at Sheffield United, and I saw a lot of the early games. He had Dean Henderson the season before, and Dean Henderson played a big part in Sheffield United. And I asked him about Ramsdale, and he said, he's a good goalkeeper. He said, unfortunately for us, he didn't make a big save early. You know, like a striker needs a goal.
The first game was against Wolves at Bramall Lane for his debut, and two goals just looped in over his hands. Yeah. And we both looked and thought, well, the journalist thought, he should have saved that. And Henderson, as he said the year before, being brilliant. And I never didn't think he ever recovered from that.
No, I think Leno's a better keeper. I thought it's one of the mistakes I would have said that I felt Arteta made, is that I felt that Leno at Fulham, who was obviously Arsenal at one time, was a better keeper. Obviously, the manager felt different. But there have been, it was a very strange performance in the end, because, you know,
they looked like they'd rallied again, and they were good. There'd been a lot of comebacks last season, and they did it again. Saka scored the equaliser 20 minutes to go. 2 minutes later, Nketiah looked like he's got the winner. And then even when Fulham went reduced to 10.
Where will be in goal next game? I think that decision was made. I think it was initially he didn't want to upset Ramsdale and gave him the chance of playing, but I don't think it's going to take a lot for him to be left out of the team.
What do you think, Alison? When Zinchenko came on and they sort of reverted back to something more recognisable from last season, where Zinchenko steps into midfield and plays as a kind of older midfielder / inverted left back, They looked much better. But Arteta's trying to do something different this year. He's trying to move in Partey from the right. He's trying to work different combinations in midfield. It's just not really working yet, is it?
Well, he's completely flipped it. He now wants to start off an attack on the wing and then move centrally, whereas last season he'd start an attack through the middle, then move wide. That's quite a flip of your brain if you're a team. And also, I don't. Maybe someone here can explain what it is. Is it purely tactical because of this new way of building an attack that he's ditching Gabriel? I don't understand. Did I imagine that he was one of their best players last season? I felt that if they were going to win the title, he should win Player of the Season, possibly.
Because, Gabriel Jesus?
Yeah.
Well, I think initially.
No, the defender.
Gabriel. Oh, sorry. Yes, the centre half. Absolutely.
I don't see why he's been moved out. And I know there's speculation that he wants to go to Saudi, but then that seems to be the excuse for anybody who's overlooked at all now. Because I'm pretty sure Saudi's asked everybody if they'll go. But has he fallen out with him because of that or of something else? But it just seems really, really strange how Arteta has responded to coming so close but failing to get the title. Instead of looking at all the positives from that season and thinking, all I have to do is just tweak it, buy in a bit of extra quality, do the same but a bit better, he seems to have thrown out a lot of what was admirable about it.
Gabriel was one of them.
And I don't know why he's not there.
Well,
without being contradictory on what I've just said there, Pep's leads the way. So when they played Manchester City played Newcastle last week, when they had the ball, it was 2-3-4-1, and Newcastle couldn't lay a glove on them. And the midfield of Tonali, Bruno Guimaraes, and Joe Linton were hugely ineffectual. You watched Gordon's performance yesterday; was nothing like it was in Manchester City. Newcastle did a one shot on target in the entire game. So I went back and checked when Man City played Liverpool at the end of last season. They beat them 4-1. Liverpool had, I think, two shots on target in the whole game. And when Manchester City played Arsenal, Manchester City won 4-1. And I think there was one shot on goal on target from Arsenal. The similarity from watching three games was that they snuffed the entire life out of these teams that pride themselves on their intensity. Newcastle have it written on the training ground. Intensity is our identity. So when Pep's teams now move forward, everybody's moving into a different position. It became very much 2-3-4-1. And Newcastle was suffocated. So all that intensity and identity that they had was negated completely. Now Arteta, when you read about him, it's like he is a junior Pep. Yeah. And he may be thinking, he's figured a way to stop us being intense. I need to find a different way. Otherwise, we can't get near him. And I would be inclined to agree with him from the early weeks of the season. I think Manchester City are way ahead of Arsenal, Liverpool and Newcastle. Perhaps Arteta is doing something very clever, but there will be a period where his players have to learn how to play this way.
It's like it looks too studious.
Yes,
it's like they
yes,
look like a bunch of school kids who've been set a geometry lesson and asked to solve it through the medium of football or something.
Isn't sport about evolution? And it's too bigger. And also the introduction of Kai Havertz. I mean, he was struggling at Chelsea to be who he can be, but not only has he moved clubs, he's got a manager who wants him to be something that he isn't as well as that. That's too big a leap, I think, for him to be playing that deep with that level of responsibility when that isn't really who he is.
So Manchester City took advantage of the slip-up at Bramall Lane, although it looked like they might not when Sheffield United equalised through Jadon Bogle. And it looked like it was going to be a difficult day for Erling Haaland, but he... And he looked very relieved to get the goal when he did. Well, and City obviously scored late to get the winner. So it was Sheffield United can be buoyed by this, I think, because they put on a good defensive display, but they still owed a lot to the sort of rare misfiring of Erling Haaland.
Well, Erling Haaland looked really peeved for quite a number of the certainly opening period where he wasn't enjoying the game, because City were just relentlessly keeping the ball. Now, I'm watching the game and I'm thinking, Sheffield United's tactics, and it was basically not really to get anywhere in dangerous positions, OK? And I understand that to a degree because it's Manchester City. But I looked at two games, there was only two games in the Premier League that Man City, the team playing them, didn't score. See what I mean? So if you're playing Man City scored in every game except a Tottenham away and Brentford away. That was the only two games they hadn't scored in. So if your tactic is really, we're not going to attempt at all to score, you cannot win this game, OK? Because they are going to take, the numbers tell you, they've only not scored, in the game at Tottenham and the game at Brentford, in the whole of last season in the Premier League. They are going to score, and it's going to take either a goalkeeper miracle or they're going to miss a lot of chances to not get the lead. So I thought it was a strange tactic. Now, when they came away from that, once they went 1-0 down, Ollie McBurney comes on, a slightly different tactics, a few more longer throws. It's not the prettiest, but then they then they got the equaliser. And yes, they were punished, but I felt I'd rather Sheffield United attempted to do something along that lines. Maybe the manager's gone, Heckingbottom's gone, do you know what? If we can keep in this game for an hour, we might be able to do something towards the end of the game. But the facts are that that team you're playing against has scored in 36 of the 38 games. So they're going to score.
But the development of the player by the good coaches is interesting. So John Stones has evolved hugely under Pep to the point now he can play as a right-back, like in step in the midfield, this kind of new position that we didn't really exist, new position before. Perhaps that's what Arteta's trying with Havertz. The game between Sheffield United and Man City is won by a bit of brilliance from Jack Grealish. Yeah. And Jack Grealish in year one under Pep struggles because it's instead of having the whole pitch to do whatever he wants on, he's got this tiny little corner on the left-hand side and he says, I didn't quite get it at first. Pep keeps faith with him. And then those closing, it was 88th minute, in those closing moments of the game, he beats his fullback, puts a beautiful cross on Haaland's head. So these great coaches. Now, and I think there's I think that's an expectation now on coaches to make players better. A lot of teams are buying players who are 22, 23, 24. Howe's brought players on, Pep has. So perhaps we have to give Arteta a little bit of patience here just to see what he can do with the players. But the development of Grealish now into a match winner is at Man City is a big change from where he was a year and a half
ago. You'll always get that with City, though. You'll always get someone producing a moment of magic. It might be Gundogan, it might be De Bruyne, it might be Grealish, it might be Foden. The team is,
Walker. He did well to kind of after gifting the goal to,
well, it's not a coincidence.
To drive his team forward again.
Well, it's not a coincidence, Gregor, that someone steps up.
Yeah.
Because that's what basically happens every week.
Yeah.
You know, Rodri's goal. You know, Rodri's a holding midfielder, but he can produce a moment of brilliance.
We've spoken quite a lot about West Ham and Spurs over the last few weeks, so we'll, rather than focusing on them, we'll focus on two stars, two of probably the biggest no-brainer signings of the summer in James Ward-Prowse, who you wrote about not long ago, Alison, and James Maddison, who
I also wrote about not so long ago.
You did, and I was at this game, and he was the best player on the pitch by a country mile. It just seems mind-boggling. And Martin, maybe you can speak about this too as Newcastle correspondent, given that Maddison was linked, and Ward-Prowse possibly could have been too, that for 30-odd million and 40-odd million, there weren't more suitors for these two players.
Yeah, no, it's phenomenal. But they fit so well. I mean, we've been talking about the nonsense of football and the disappointments of football, and we've been questioning managers' tactical nous and decisions made. But actually here, what you've got is football working properly, because I think James Maddison feels he was destined for Spurs. He's a traditional Spurs type player. He's someone who admired and actually said to me, I modelled my game on Christian Eriksen when Christian Eriksen was the heartbeat of Spurs, and he's slotted into that role. He's brought back to Spurs that sense of just making the team tick and knowing the right pass to make and bringing flair to the team. That feels like a destiny signing, and he wanted to go when they wanted him, so bravo football for getting that right. And James Ward-Prowse, you've got a manager, David Moyes, who didn't listen to his director of football and said, no, I want him. I want James Ward-Prowse, because we are very good at set pieces, but we need someone who can deliver them. And that's what they've got. They've got someone who takes the finest corner, the finest free kick in the Premier League, on a consistent level. He never puts a foot wrong with a set piece, James Ward-Prowse. And he's undervalued as someone who interlinks in the outfield play as well. Absolutely perfect West Ham player, and he said in his most recent interview, James Ward-Prowse, just how beautifully it's all settled in for him. They've made him feel welcome, he feels useful, it's perfect. And that's they're two examples of managers insisting, the players knowing it, the people around the players knowing it, not waiting for some bigger fee for Saudi money or something that isn't suitable, or going to Manchester City and sitting on the bench for a season. They've said, no, this is your moment. You fit this club. Everyone's done the right thing, and they will shine all year, I'm sure.
Couldn't agree more. Two absolute great fits for both clubs. With regards to Newcastle, dead keen on Maddison last summer. Couldn't agree a fee. Keen on him again in January. Couldn't agree a fee. Their interest cooled a bit this summer, in part because Eddie Howe has admitted that he fell in love with watching Tonali, and Newcastle do have a ceiling on their spend because of the financial fair play. So that kind of moved them away from Maddison. Ward-Prowse, I think, is a phenomenal signing for £30 million. The only thing and again, Newcastle liked him. The only reason I would say, and this is my opinion, is that they have Kieran Trippier, who I think delivered 84 goal and scoring opportunities from set plays. And Ward-Prowse was second with 40-odd. So you'd go, if you buy Ward-Prowse, it's like, what are you going to do? Who's going to take the free kick? So I think it was a case of, well, we have somebody who can do a lot of that and we want a different kind of midfielder. But two great players.
I would add on to that. The three best free kick takers I ever played with, and Ward-Prowse's reason I'm going to mention him is because I think one of them he's very like, is that Kevin Sheedy at Everton was unbelievable at dead balls. Dennis Irwin at Man United, Dennis was likewise, unbelievable right or left foot. And then there was David Beckham. And I think Ward-Prowse's free kick taking is as good as David Beckham's. And that's a very high bar. Because, you know, you look at his numbers last year and the year before, they're pretty exceptional. And yes, there's penalties included on that. And as Alison alluded to, you know, if you're one set pieces and you know your side are exceptionally good, they're going to score goals. And he will chip in as well. He's not just a free kick taker. He can score from, you know, like he did in open play as well.
Oh, he works hard. He reads the game really well. He's a great buy.
Yeah. Just on Maddison, I mean, did anybody see the little moment on social media where he dragged the ball out of the...
He was getting a lot of grief
from the Bournemouth fans for, in the opening stages. One song about Gareth Southgate thinking he wasn't very good.
I'm being correct in that.
Yeah, and so he in the corner flag, he dragged the ball out of the quadrant and they were all howling abuse again, and then he just looked up at them and said, yeah, diving. And rolled it back. So he brings fun as well. Spurs, there's you know, we've spoken about this. Spurs feel a lot more enjoyable to watch, and I think he's been a big reason for that.
Gregor, can we give him a compliment about going to Spurs when Harry Kane's leaving? He would have known Harry Kane was leaving the football club when he joined. So he's prepared to go to a club that sold their biggest star.
Take the pressure as well. I think he loves it as well. He loves the pressure. He loves to be centre of attention.
Does he take the penalties?
I don't know.
Have they had one? I think Son
take the first one. No, it's funny how quickly perceptions change. You lose Kane. Kane's been brilliant for X amount of years. Blah, blah, blah. Then you go Son, Maddison. Can you get something out of Richarlison at some point, the player that he can be for Brazil? Kulusevski's going well, and they've got a pot of money in the bank. Quite a progressive manager. Can they take, you know, a bit of half decent start of the season and build on it, and suddenly turn around the thought of this club from last year being weak and on the way down? Maybe he's with another sign on or two, and Maddison plays a huge part in that. They can have a little bit more optimism than maybe they've had for a season or two.
Can we not mention just briefly, because it struck me this weekend, of Tottenham changing their goalkeeper and three of their back four in the last, you know, since the end of last season, really. You know, that's what Newcastle did. Newcastle changed basically their goalkeeper, three of their back four, very, very, in a very short space of time. They've done that, and that's been a standout feature for me as well. That, you know, not, that's a hard gig to do. Centre half, left back, right back, goalkeeper, in a very short space of time.
They gave up some chances. That's not because they can't defend, it's because of the way they play.
The way they play, I was going to say.
It's good to watch, though.
But, you know, it's still a big gig to do that.
Yeah.
You were looking forward to going, Gregor. Did they disappoint you, or was it
perfunctionary? First half, there were spells where they were brilliant. Because Bournemouth have such a high press and they're so intense, and obviously Iraola is like clearly so committed to that style of play. And the first 3 or 4 minutes, it looked like, you know, both teams recognised what each other were, and they were going to play the way they played anyway, regardless. So Spurs managed to give Philip Billing a chance in the opening few minutes and create two chances of their own by trying to play through their press. And you thought, this is going to be a great game. And it was for the first half, and then second half, I think they kind of ran out of steam a little bit. But it was Spurs are going to be exciting to watch, no doubt, this season. Finally, after you were at this game, I think, Alison, after Joachim Andersen equalised for Crystal Palace with what can only be described as a slide tackle through the legs of Brentford's goalkeeper Mark Flecken. Cass, you've written about the scrappiest goal you've ever scored, and we wondered if we could think of the scrappiest goals we've ever seen here. Yeah. The scrappiest.
Sorry.
Go on, Cass, tell us about it.
Yeah, playing for Aston Villa. And I'd got a reminder of it. Oh, I've had it a few times where people have just sort of, is this one of the worst Premier League goals in history? And I look at it, well, no, actually, I was quite delighted at the time, but it was against Derby, and it's literally a melee, and obviously you can see it on Times Online, where basically every, and the pitch isn't good as well. It's, you know, it's a typical pitch of where it's all dug up all over the place in the 18-yard box. And I'm just standing out on the right, and there's this big melee kicking going everywhere, and it suddenly gets rolled to me, and I tap it in. But you have to see it, because it's funny, like, because it was me, and I think, that's the only thing I've ever won, the scrappiest cup.
Scruffiest.
Scruffiest.
But apparently scruffiest. You peeled away celebrating like you'd won the World Cup, I'm told.
Well, I let's put it this way. It was, I loved it at Villa. I really enjoyed it. I was really sad to leave after, what, best part of 15 months. But I really enjoyed my period at that club. It was a great football club.
That's a hilarious goal, and you can see that on the Times website along with Tony's column and lots of great content. Tony, Alison, Martin, thanks for joining me. Make sure you're subscribed, and we'll be back on Thursday.
approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.